Welcome to the Cars Coffee Theology Podcast. CCT is dedicated to providing you caffeinated vehicular conversations with thoughtful people. Our main medium is our YouTube channel, but we also wanted to provide you an audio-only version of all the episodes from Chapter 1. So here it is. Thanks for tuning in.
We want to give our hearty thanks to B&H Publishing for sponsoring this episode. To learn more about Russ Moore's award-winning book, check out stormtossfamily.com. Thanks again, B&H. My guest today is Dr. Russ Moore, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission, award-winning author, and my former boss. We enjoyed a drive around Nashville, including a visit to the great Stay Golden coffee shop. Cars,
coffee. Well, this is very exciting for me. I appreciate it.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is awesome.
Glad to.
So I have a gift for you that you may already have already.
Oh, but I do not.
You don't have that?
Oh, that's okay. Awesome.
Yeah, so now, I'm not going to have you wear it. Comes with a wearable tiara. That may be the end of your job. that may be taking it a little too far. Everything else. But maybe if at some point you want to wear that in the privacy of your own home.
Maybe so, yeah. So, I'll neither confirm nor deny that. Well, thanks a lot.
So it's really a very interesting, I just glanced through it, a very interesting history of Wonder Woman from the comic books all the way through our mutually beloved Linda Carter, of course. And so I knew
this. She lives here now.
Does she really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
She lives in
Have you tried to reach out there?
I have not. No, that would not go well in my house. Because my two big crushes of my childhood and teenage life both live in Nashville.
Who's the other one?
Amy Grant.
Okay, of course. Have you had any contact with her? That would be more likely you'd run into her, probably.
Yeah, I have, yeah. But okay. She is, I was absolutely in love with Amy Grant all through.
She was amazing.
Yeah. Middle school, high school, yeah.
Okay, well, I liked Linda Carter as well.
Yeah.
But it made me think about who I loved was Elizabeth Montgomery from Bewitched.
Yeah.
There was something about Elizabeth Montgomery that was my childhood crush for
sure. Yeah, not for me. She seemed too momish to me, I think.
She wasn't the power woman that Linda Carter was. Yeah, she was cutesy and have a wife that could do magic. I mean, come on.
Right.
I
mean, right.
I guess you'd have a goddess in this case. Right. That's not all bad either.
Goddess.
Right,
is all.
Right.
Ask for much.
Right.
Well, and it's really interesting, her creator, William Moulton Marston, was a piece of work. I mean, there's
very feminist kind of approach.
Well,
to things.
He was very feminist, but he was also was the inventor of the lie detector. He's a psychologist.
Really? Oh, I missed that detail.
Well, that's why she has the golden lasso. Makes you tell the truth.
Oh my goodness.
He was a polyamorist in a day when that was not.
Right.
Something anyone ever thought about.
Right.
And so
when are we talking, the 20s?
No. This 30s? Would have been in the 30s. Yeah.
30s, okay.
And he thought that comic books were creating toxic masculinity.
I did read that. You said that in the book. Right.
So he wanted to correct that. And he was a classical scholar in Greek mythology.
Yeah, so the Diana.
So all of that flowed together, you know.
What did you think of the recent Wonder Woman movie? I thought it was really good.
I did too.
That whole world of those.
I liked it, yeah. Right. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
It's the other world. And here, you know, I'm a Marvel, not a DC guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I like you a lot, but I don't understand the DC thing, man. Except for the Chris Nolan Batman. I don't like any of the DC people.
Oh, the Chris Nolan Batman was the worst.
Oh, my goodness. That's the only good Batman that's out there.
No.
Okay, well, at least we're consistent in our differences of opinion.
That's correct.
Because I'm a Marvel man. In fact, our family, my wife has hardly seen any of those, so we've made a commitment. We are watching all 20 Marvel movies in the Marvel Universe chronology, not the order they were released in.
Yeah.
So we started back with Captain America, and then we did Iron Man 1. So we're systematically working through them in preparation for the. But maybe you don't even care. Are you like so DC you don't even want to hear anything about Marvel?
No, you like them both? No. I'm a DC guy, but I will admit that in terms of the cinematic universes, so far Marvel's done better, which is part of the shame because the. The actual universe, DC, has so much superiority to it. Yeah, that it really deserves a better cinematic representation than what it's had.
Well, Superman, I mean, come on. Like, nobody can beat him in anything.
Well, sure they can.
But, like, in the Superman movie, it's like...
He's vulnerable to kryptonite. He's vulnerable to magic. He's vulnerable to a parasite. Siphon is...
What was your first car?
My first car was a green Ford pickup truck that was older than I was, and was a just a tank of a vehicle.
Right.
Didn't have very good brakes. I had three wrecks in 3 weeks after getting
because
my
of the
driver's
brakes,
license.
You
well,
were a victim.
No, it was. The brakes were part of it, yeah.
Okay.
Brakes were part of it. Part of it was I had no business having a driver's license. In Mississippi at the time, you could get your permit at 14, license at 15.
Right.
I was not ready to be behind a wheel at 15 years old.
That is pretty amazing to think of.
Yeah.
So one other question I have, if you'll open this up and tell me what's going on in this picture.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a number of things happening here.
Yes, it's a beautiful combination
right.
of things.
Yeah, someone, and I don't remember.
I can't remember who it was either.
Did this because they took the picture from, I was speaking at the Vatican in 2014, and I was going through the line in order to get in with the Swiss Guard.
Right.
And had in my, I had in my passport in my coat pocket, and reached in and pulled it out. I thought, but I was wearing the same suit that I had been in, lecturing on Reformation the week before, and I pulled out a copy of Luther's 95 Theses.
Right.
So anyway, I took a picture there. Well, someone knew that, and then they also knew that when I took my kids to see Goosebumps movie. That when that ventriloquist clown, whatever his name is right now, it escapes me, shows up on the screen, my then baby, Taylor, yelled out, "Daddy," in the theater. So somebody's put those two things together.
Yeah, that's right. And you love Halloween.
I know.
I mean, that's kind of part
all
of
that works.
Right.
Yep,
like
all of that
multi-layered
works.
Intertextual picture.
Right.
We'll show a picture of it because it's so. It's such a funny picture.
Right.
Before we turn to talk about some of your work, I guess probably the most important question I would ask is, like, who was the greatest professor you ever hired at Southern?
Well, I often tell people you were one of my best hires at Southern.
All right. Hey, Siri, give me a number between 1 and 300. All right. So as you may have seen, I like to have authors read a random paragraph, and I didn't want you to stack the deck and choose your favorite page or something.
Okay.
So page 144.
You
got to read something out of the Stormtoss family there, which again I just finished yesterday and really, really enjoy it.
Okay, so where on the page?
Wherever you like, any paragraph you like.
Okay, all right. A common theme I have observed in adulterous affairs is that the one, I mean, see, this is, my wife's going to watch this, and so you're talking about your crushes on Amy Grant and Linda Carter, now you're talking about adulterous affairs. A common theme I have observed in adulterous affairs is that the one cheating is almost never looking for a new spouse to replace the deficiencies of the old one. He or she is seeking to recapture the feeling of adolescence. See, this is the problem. Or young adulthood. They are not so much looking for sexual sensation as for drama. And for a short period of time, the person can be swept up into the drama of I love you, do you love me type of romance.
Tell me the truth with your rope, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right.
El Shaddai.
That's right. Without all the burdens of who is picking up Chloe from school or what day to put the recycling bin out at the curb.
No, you're really right. So, yeah, that's very insightful. Okay, so you want to launch from that and just kind of talk about what you're doing in this chapter, or really the whole book. Like, why did you write this book? Anything about that?
I wrote the book because I was dealing constantly with people in various areas of family crisis. They're all very different. So a lot of people who were in this sort of situation, which seems from the outside looking in to be so obviously irrational. Where have you ever seen this to fix your problem?
Well.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But of course, it's not a rational issue.
And one thing that I've it's kind of shifted for my wife and me is a move from what our kids should be to what they could be, meaning in the sense that I think when we were younger, we had only this mindset of would this did have a lot of idealism that every kid needed to look like this.
Right.
And an increased awareness of that each child's calling and their personality and these things like that. I mean, obviously there are some standards, but there's so much to how God's made them.
Right.
That was a real change for us that's happened in the last, like, even 5 to 10 years, just to focus on how God might be calling each child to develop and who they are, instead of, for us, it was this really, and so I felt like it was really life-giving along those lines too, just encouraging, because it was, you know, several moments where you just kind of recognize there's not just one way to do this kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So. An exciting week that you won the Christianity Today Award Book of the Year for Beautiful Orthodoxy, I think they call it, or something like that. Is that what the title is?
I thought that was funny because when I saw there's a wearable tiara, because Tish Harrison Warren, who won last year for Liturgy of the Ordinary, put up on Twitter an image of a Miss America transferring the crown and said, I'll get you your tiara later this week. And
God's will. It was me. I'm the messenger.
I started to joke about Anglicans offering crowns always makes me nervous as a Baptist. But so here we have the tiara. She doesn't even have to send it.
That's funny. I didn't know you were honored. And then I saw the pictures of getting the cover done. And is this right? With a piece of a shirt from Johnny Cash.
Right, because the artist who did that original piece of work works for the Johnny Cash Museum, the Johnny Cash Homestead,
wow,
and so forth.
Okay.
And so he knew that I was a Johnny Cash fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came up with this piece of art that took one of Cash's shirts, he shredded it and made the water.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, that's his shirt. Then he took a hymnal and made this house.
Oh, I hadn't
house.
Noticed that before. Okay.
Yeah. Right. The cover of my last book, Onward, was done by Hat Show Print, the classic music industry poster maker.
Yeah, it looks like that, yeah.
Yeah, and they used an old Johnny Cash Sun Records album as the background for that.
Right, that's great. All right, well, let's get back to the book. Anything else you'd want to say in terms of your motivation, your desire for the book? Like, why did you write this? You're saying a lot of people come to you with stories, but what's the vision you're trying to sort of cast for people?
About 10 years ago now, I wrote a book called Adopted for Life, which was really a way of sort of wrestling with myself through what I had gone through in the process of being someone who was, would have thought of myself as pro-adoption, but very reluctant to adopt. So going through that process, that was sort of my working through what I had learned in that process as a way of almost speaking to my younger self, someone who's in that situation.
Okay.
And so as I was working on this, for me, it was almost an adopted for life for the whole family.
Marriage and parenting and everything.
Because it's a very similar situation with, I think I mentioned in the book having a friend who said to me, I knew that we're talking about parenting. Mm-hmm. I knew that parenting would be humbling. I just didn't know that it would be humiliating.
Yeah, that was a great line. I remember that one. Yeah.
And, as soon as he said it, I said, that's exactly right. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, ultimately, every aspect of family is humiliating.
You talk about parenting with the end in mind, which was, again, the whole book was super encouraging. But that, as well, how I thought about it is playing the long game with your children. And that's what's really hard when you're a younger parent, and maybe even, when you're a younger parent, is to play the long game and realize I'm raising adults, that are going to, of course, screw up.
Right.
And make mistakes and have all kinds of problems. But if I keep in mind this kind of long game of it, then that frees me up to not be so anxious again, and to be present with them in the now.
As I go down each of my children, I am a better parent with, you know, down to the youngest
one.
What's
the difference? What are you aware of? Why?
The difference is because I know what to freak out about and what not to freak out about.
Right.
Really at every stage, whether it's temper tantrums, you know, happening as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, you still deal with them, but you're not thinking, oh no, what does this mean? I think it was my mother who said one time, and we were in the middle of potty training, the first two, and I was just very anxious about it. This wasn't going as quickly and well as I thought it would be.
According to your plan.
Yeah, and she said, you know what? Have you ever met anybody in your life who's grown, but who doesn't have some sort of medical issue, who's not potty trained just because they didn't learn it?
Right.
I said, no. It's okay. Then this is going to happen.
That's good.
Most of the dangerous areas for evangelical Christianity is putting an either or where there's a both and, in a way that the reverse, of course, is true too. Mm-hmm. There's a danger of putting a both and where there should be an either or. So one can't say both God and Baal, both Jesus and Mammon. No, it's either or, one or the other. But I think because we do recognize that and we know that, sometimes there's a tendency to then create everything into either or situations that actually just fuels whatever it is that you're afraid of.
Yep. Thought there was just a lot of good, thoughtful balance that was coming out of conviction that was winsome, which is really beautiful in the book. That's really great. And I think, you know, whenever we're motivated, kind of speaking from what you were saying, whenever we're motivated by fear, that is, I think, when imbalance is for sure close to hand.
Yeah,
you know, on either side.
Right. Because I think what happens is usually, at least this is what I've noticed in myself, when I'm operating out of fear, what I'm saying is because I experienced X, I want to make sure that I stay as far away from that as humanly possible to keep it from happening. So it becomes, you know, wherever it is, theologically or ideologically, it becomes exactly what Jesus is identifying with the Pharisees, building hedges around the law to make sure that one doesn't get close to falling off of it. And there are always very good reasons for that.
Yep.
Because one can say,
the conservatives of the day, right?
Yeah, and they're saying, we have seen what happens when this happens, and of course that's true. But it just, you can see it in individual people's lives, you can see it in the lives of churches, you can see it in the lives of movements, where what's happening is all an attempt to avoid the last bad thing in a way that blinds one to what is the next bad thing.
Favorite Johnny Cash song? And why? And I don't really know, I hate to admit, I don't really know much about Johnny Cash. I'm like the worst person to interview you I'm not going to even recognize any of the titles you give me, but I will dedicate myself to educating myself, starting with your recommendation.
Well, I like Johnny Cash as a sort of all-around person. Johnny Cash is not by any means my favorite songwriter.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
All right. As a matter of fact, Maria, my wife, was explaining to someone a year or so ago, she said, if you want to really understand my husband, the way you understand it is to know that everybody thinks that Johnny Cash is his favorite songwriter, and he does love Johnny Cash. But if you actually look at his music,
playlist or something,
his playlist, it actually is Jimmy Buffett.
Okay.
Is going to show up more than anyone. But, she said, and this is the key, it's not the Margaritaville sort of Jimmy Buffett songs. It's the Jimmy Buffett's Meditations on Death sort of. So,
So it combines your Halloween
death of an unpopular poet. He went to Paris.
See, I don't really know much Jimmy Buffett besides Margaritaville. Because you go on a cruise, you go all over the world, there's like Margaritavilles, you know, everywhere.
Right. But I think with Johnny Cash, I mean, I would be partial to Walk the Line.
Okay. That I do know, right?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things I like to do, too, is have a random element to it. So down there in the pocket, you'll see some envelopes with different random questions in it. And you can choose one, doesn't matter which one. And though that maybe that one's already opened.
Is it not supposed to be open?
I don't know. Let me see what's going on with the level here. I think that's an old one.
Oh, it's an old one.
So,
okay.
So we put it back in there. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, choose one that's not open. Sorry about that. And you can answer it, and then I'll try to answer it too. So, add a little random element to it.
What is your greatest extravagance?
Okay. That you want to put on camera. And we can let your wife go back and.
You know, I think what she would say is the greatest extravagance. And she got me as a present one time this chewy nugget ice maker with the, it's the
what does that even mean?
Well, it's a specific kind of the small chewy ice that you can get at some, you know, like gas stations. It used to be at Hardee's.
It's pretty rare to find those. Yeah,
right. And so this makes that.
Okay.
And so I have that.
You have it in your house? Do you use it all the time?
I use it all the time, every day, all the time. And
so you feel it when you go to a restaurant that doesn't have that. It's like, if you're used to that kind of ice.
Yeah. The coffee maker at our house is in the bedroom.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I'm not going to, you know, I need that. Right.
You read in the morning and in bed, isn't that right? How do I know that about you?
Yeah, but also I just need to, I need to start caffeinating very, very quickly. The ice machine's in the bed.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So when do you use the ice though? In the morning as well?
All day long. Yeah.
Like to just chew on it or in drinks?
No. I drink water on it or.
So you go through a lot of beverages.
Iced tea.
Like.
Yeah. I was. In Louisville.
We'll put that in the extravagance category, definitely.
Yeah.
Right?
In Louisville, the doctor said to me, how much caffeine do you drink in a day? And I said, well, I was trying to think it through. I said, in the morning, I make a pot of coffee. And he said, well, do you all like drink on that all day? I said, well, no.
I make a pot of coffee, right?
Right then. And then, I said, it wasn't the sum of it. I'm just telling you, this is how we start.
Right.
Yeah. So are you supposed to answer?
I'm supposed to answer, too. Yeah, greatest extravagance. Oh, my. I hate these questions. They're hard to come up with the answer.
Do you write these questions or someone else?
Well, I mean, I collected a bunch and threw them in envelopes like 6 months ago, so I don't remember them or know what we're going to get, obviously. Greatest extravagance. Maybe this car, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, father of six didn't need a midlife crisis.
Right. Is that when this happened?
Engine.
Was it a midlife crisis
not
thing?
Really. I mean, it's just.
How old are you? Got it?
I've had it a few years, so.
But like,
I was probably
years?
45.
Oh, okay, well, then of course it was a midlife crisis.
I was definitely midlife. I didn't know that I was really going through a crisis. I actually saw this when we were looking at Mustangs.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw the doors like open. It's got these suicide doors that open the other way.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with it. And so I bought it. Just bought it and didn't know anything about the car. Didn't know that the engines all die on these. So like I said, I had to rebuild the engine just recently, but I just love, you know, it was a stick shift and I just, so this was my one spurge of life.
If you
really,
have to look through John Rawls' veil of ignorance toward choosing one's midlife crisis, a car is pretty good.
Much, much better
You're
than
much
a lot of other options.
Off than,
yeah.
than almost all the
right,
other options.
Right, yeah. This is my little piece of human flourishing on wheels.
Uh-huh.
So that's my extravagance probably.
I just heard from, I saw that you've blurbed it, this little a concise guide to reading the New Testament.
I saw that you liked it a lot too. Yes, it was delightful, I know.
It really was, and I picked it up just as, you know, might this be something good to give to a college student or that sort of thing, and then I just happened to flip it open and said, this is really, really good.
It is really excellent, yeah.
And the author sent me an email last night, a really nice email last night.
Oh, good,
The Seattle Pacific.
The house, yeah.
But I hope he keeps writing. Because there's, I think a lot more where that came from.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a new era in biblical studies. It's finally kind of rediscovering canon and theology, which has been a big part of my own scholarly life, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
And moving beyond kind of these dichotomies between theology and biblical studies and all this kind of stuff. So
I'm reading right now, he's a friend of mine, he's an Antiochian Orthodox priest, and he has a little Eastern Orthodox commentary on Romans.
Okay. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Which I expect, of course, I will be completely at odds with once we get to atonement and justification. Yeah.
Maybe not completely.
But I mean, I know Father Paz. I know there'll be some significant areas of difference. But the first chapter is magnificent, where he's just sort of outlining a life of Paul, and he's showing intertextual connections with Saul of 1 Samuel and Saul of Tarsus.
Yeah, very canonical theological kind of reading.
And it's just a really, really, really well done
My argument has always been that great preachers have always been better than our modernist hermeneutic.
Yes.
And that's the irony of it, is that we actually know how to make those kind of canonical connections, but then we're kind of taught when we adopt a kind of modernist view that that's not okay to do. You know what I mean?
Well, and not even just preachers. Anyone who sings Christmas carols knows how to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you really cannot make sense of Matthew 1 and 2 and Luke 1 and 2 with the sort of reading that modernism gives us.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Including, I mean, it's so interesting to me because all of the people that I would hear who were so worried about, well, you know, you're going to get into all of these jumps and sort of hermeneutical gymnastics. If you go, and I look around and say, but they're the ones doing the craziest gymnastics and trying to make sense of "Out of Egypt I called my son."
You're preaching the choir now. I agree.
You know, we had Carl Henry come into a J-term at Southern one time on the history of American evangelicalism.
Really?
Yeah. And it became legendary on the campus because Dr. Henry got up and said, started off and said, "It's history of American evangelicalism." He said this with no irony at all. "It's the history of American evangelicalism. We will start at the very beginning. I was born on October the 3rd, 1917.
Only he could pull that off.
Only he could do that. That actually makes sense.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Absolutely, yeah.
Time of life
good
for you
to
with
see
a lot
you.
Going on, and congratulations.
Oh, thanks so much. I'll keep this.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode. I know you're tempted to stop the recording right now and not listen to what I'm about to say, but it's really important. Make sure you subscribe to our social media and especially our YouTube channel. We also have a Patreon account if you want to support us that way. Thanks again. We'll see you on the road.